Good morning. In the wee hours of the morning this past Thursday, Brother Fred Weiss suffered a very serious and damaging heart attack. He was taken to the hospital where he was admitted, put in the coronary care unit, and stabilized into Thursday, and had a restful night somewhat on Thursday night, but on Friday began to take a turn for the worst. Blood pressure dropped severely. He was not able to survive the damage to his heart, and he went to be with the Lord around noon on Friday. This afternoon, from 3 until 4:30, we'll have a viewing at the Thomas McAfee Funeral Home. And then the funeral will be tomorrow here at the church at 11 o'clock. So please be praying for Dorothea, that the Lord would comfort her. And let's remember, in a church the size of ours, and it's a good thing for us all to slip in and show our support, but let's suppose, for example, that we have 300 people show up. You know how long you'll have if we have 300 people to go to a viewing that lasts between 3 and 4:30? 33 seconds apiece. Okay? If you take more than that, it's going to encroach into the evening service. Folks will be late. Mrs. Weiss will be worn out. So the important thing to do is to stop by, shake her hand, give her a hug, keep moving. Okay? Let's remember that. One of the reasons that she scheduled it so briefly this afternoon is because of the exhaustion that is involved often in this kind of a thing. So let's remember that, please. Okay? This afternoon, 3 to 4:30, funeral tomorrow, 11 o'clock, right here. Any of the deacons, I have names of some that I'm going to be talking to already, but any of you deacons who were able to build a relationship with Brother Weiss or with Mrs. Weiss, if you would, if you knew them and were able to speak to him from time to time, if you would see me right after service, I have something I need for you to do for me. And let's just really pray for the family that the Lord would bless there. Glad to have all of you here today. We'll be outside in the foyer signing books again for you. The stocks are moving rapidly out of our stores, okay? We have several hundred left, but they're not going to last long. We're promoting the book in the Hidden Treasure Report and in the upcoming copy of The Faith Works. And so I think we had about 500 or 600 or so go over to Bob Jones the other day. And so we'll not have a whole lot. So if you want to get one here and be able to help Hidden Treasure Christian School, you do so. Otherwise, it's in the Christian bookstores. Somebody told me they saw it over Crossway the other day. So we do need to be encouraging our friends, if you want to encourage somebody to get it, to go to the Christian bookstores and get it, so that we won't deplete all those that we have here for folks who might be writing to the school. Okay? Well, this Sunday school program has been exciting, hasn't it? It's been sort of guess what we have this Sunday type thing for the last few weeks. We have some good ideas. We have a lot more discussion to go through and some other plans that need to be made in order to discern what we're going to do on the long range. But we want to try our best to make sure that the materials that you're receiving is helpful and interesting and biblical, so that when you go away from Sunday school, you won't say, man, I wish they'd taught on that other thing. I hope that it'll be beneficial enough to you that you'll appreciate whatever we teach. I got a call from Pastor Bumpus. He stopped by yesterday and looked at our buildings. And when he got back to Schaumburg late last night, he called me. He's got an interesting program he does. They only have their classes during the school year. And then they change everything at the end of the school year. And they bring in special speakers every Sunday to speak on specific topics. And he wanted me to come and speak on a particular topic at some point. But it was a very interesting concept. So we're looking for a lot of different ideas to be able to help ourselves until we can find some way either to make some subdivisions in here or to organize our classes a little differently. When the construction's over, of course, it'll be a little easier for us to be flexible and to do some things. But keep praying for us about that. I want to continue right on. You say, well, man, I don't even remember where we were. I already forgot. Let me tell you a story about forgetting. Okay? Heard this story recently. This is awful. Tell jokes about people who get old and get forgetful. But I'm going to tell you anyway because it's funny. But this elderly man, elderly woman, they were both getting a little bit forgetful. And he was a widower and she was a widow. And they'd become good friends. And they thought, well, you know, we love each other and we like to spend time together. And we ought to just go ahead and get married. You heard this? And so we just go ahead and get married. So finally the fellow just got up his nerve and he said, I'm going to ask her to marry me. So he asked her one night if she'd marry him. And the next morning he got up and, boy, he could not remember to save his life whether she said yes or no. And he thought, what am I going to do? Boy, if she said no, I shouldn't go over there anymore, I guess. But if she said yes, well, oh, man, what am I going to do? He agonized over it all day. So finally he says, look, I just got to be a man about this thing. Go over there and tell her I can't remember. So, and ask her again. And so he went over there and he knocked on the door. She came to the door and he said, look, he says, this is really embarrassing. He said, I asked you to marry me last night and I cannot remember to save my life whether you said yes or no. And she said, oh, thank heaven. She says, I knew somebody asked me to marry him, but I couldn't remember who it was. So, I've been trying my best to remember where we were, and you probably have too. Well, here's where we were. We were studying through our church constitution together, and we had come to a point just before we moved over to this building where we were talking about employees and personnel policies. You know, it's amazing to me how some people love the results but still reserve for themselves the right to criticize the process that produces the results. You understand what I'm saying? There are some people who, when they look at a particular business or a school or a church or a family, they'll say, you sure have sweet kids. I wish you'd let them watch TV or something like that. Or, boy, your kids are so precious. They're so well behaved. I just don't understand why you won't let them go trick-or-treating or something like that. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, they love the product that certain parents are producing by the way they're raising their kids, but they reserve for themselves the right to criticize and complain about the process that's being used. You understand what I'm saying? Sometimes people don't draw a cause and effect relationship between policies and procedures that are established to produce a given result and that given result. I suppose those of you who've gone to Bob Jones or some other strict school have heard some of those similar things. There's an appreciation for the result, but there's not an appreciation for the process that produces the result. And there is no greater source or, I suppose, area of controversy in this particular thing than biblical Christianity itself. Biblical Christianity produces a kind of life that is a joyful life. But those looking from the outside in often reserve for themselves the right to criticize and complain about what they perceive to be the rigidity and the sternness of the law rather than the blessings of the order that the law produces. You follow? Now, I've heard many people say to us, boy, whatever you have at Faith, that's such a blessing. I mean, the servant's heart that you have there and the way the people throw in together and work together, boy, and the giving spirit, why, that's remarkable. I've heard other people, I've had relatives who visited here and say, oh, what unusual people. Well, that's true. But there could be that same unusual result if the unusual thing of biblical obedience, okay, were more common in other places as well. Now, I'm not trying to be unkind. I'm simply saying that there are oftentimes people who like what they see here, as elsewhere, who don't draw the connection between the choices and the policies that we put into effect and the results that are obtained. That is not to say that we are taking credit for that which is obviously of the grace of God. All right? But there are ways to make ourselves accessible to the grace of God. I don't mean to say worthy. That's a concept that's foreign to the concept of grace. We don't make ourselves worthy of God's grace. It wouldn't be grace. But there are ways that we can appropriate God's grace. You have to be where the grace is being given, you see. You heard the story about the old fellow after a night of carousing. Lost his car keys. And he was down on his hands and knees under the street light and he was just scouring the ground. And a fellow came along. He said, what are you doing? He said, looking for my keys. He said, well, I'll help you. And so they looked around for a long time. And he says, man, he says, I don't see them anywhere. He said, where'd you lose them? He said, I lost them over there. He said, what are we doing here? He said, well, there's no light over there. Now, some people are just ridiculous about the way they approach things. In other words, they're trying to solve their problem, but they're not going where the answer is, you see. If you want to solve your problem, you have to go where the answer to the problem is, you see. And the same thing is true when we allow the Lord to work in our lives. We must put ourselves in the place where He has told us that He's going to work. Now, we know from Matthew chapter 22, verses 36 through 40, that there are two primary principles that provide the hinges on which the door of all truth swing open. You know the passage. The Pharisee had come to the Lord and tried to trip him up, and he couldn't. The Lord silenced him with his wise answers. Well, then a doctor of the law came to the Lord. And remember, when it talks about a lawyer in the Bible, it doesn't mean an attorney. It means a man who is schooled in the Old Testament, the Pentateuch particularly. And this man came and he said, which is the great commandment in the law? And the Lord said to him, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And then immediately he said, and the second is likened to it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And then he made a marvelous statement. On these two hang all the law and the prophets. Now the law referred to the Pentateuch. The prophets was a designation that the Hebrews used to refer to the rest of the Old Testament. So when the Lord said, on these two hang all the law and the prophets, what he was saying was this. On these two relationships, when biblically maintained, when those two relationships are strived for and achieved according to the Bible, all other truth can be built or based. Those two relationships are foundational. What are they? Right relationship with God and a right relationship with man. Now, one of the marvels that we have to face today is that we place so much emphasis in our fundamental churches on how to have a right relationship with God, but then we don't spell out what we're going to do in order to have a right relationship with man. You see? You pick up the average church constitution and it will be filled with doctrinal principles that spell out the requirements for having a right relationship with God. But there's very little said publicly, officially, and deliberately about how to resolve conflicts with others. And that's unfortunate, because we are preaching a ministry of reconciliation. We have a message of reconciliation. We believe, as Bible-believing Christians, separated, obedient, Bible-believing Christians, that we have a clearer presentation of the ministry of reconciliation than anybody. And yet, often we do not mirror or picture that reconciliation in our own relationships. Now, why is that? It's because we spend so much time talking about being reconciled to God without holding each other responsible to being reconciled to men. Now, one of the biggest problems that happens in our lives is that conflicts come up and we don't have a proper procedure outlined for the resolution of those conflicts. Parental discipline is, in essence, a prearranged set of principles whereby we will deal with inter-family conflicts. Who's going to be in charge? You see, if whenever the children are disobedient, and that's going to happen in every family, if you do not have pre-arranged agreements of who's going to get his way, you have constant strife and struggle. If you establish a system of force in the family rather than a system of authority, then the biggest person will get his way. And that's what most parents are trapped into doing when their children are little. Because when the parents are bigger, they can always get their way. But then what are they going to do when, instead of establishing biblical authority, they have only used the force principle of saying, I'm the biggest, I'm the oldest, I'm the wisest, I pay the food, as long as you put your feet under my table, etc., etc., etc. You're going to do what I say. What are you going to do when the kid's bigger than mom and dad? Then they usurp the club from mom and dad, you see? And if the way we provoke or promote obedience in the home is through the use of a club, well, then you have to fight for the rest of your life to determine who gets the club, you see? But if you establish a principle of biblical authority,
well, then we understand that everybody is under God's authority. Now, what we sought to do in this particular section of our Constitution is to spell out concerning everybody in the church who is serving, which includes everybody in responsibility, but not everybody in fact, okay? Everybody who's supposed to be serving, which is everybody, is like a train on a track. In order for the train to get where it's going, all the cars have to be in line. Now, that doesn't mean that the car in front is better than the car behind it, or that the car in the middle is better than the car at the end. This is just some prearranged setup that we have to make sure that all the cars stay on the track. You see? And this train is related, in a sense, through these couplings that are made, and that picture is the chain of command. Now, if car number 2 or 3 or 4 or 50 decides, this is not fair, I'm not being treated rightly, I should be able to be equal with the cars up front, and they decide they're going to jump the track and get up there and run side by side, the train's going to derail, you see? And it's going to tear up a lot of things, because train wrecks are bad news, okay? Now, everybody's, you know, you've heard the word train wreck to be used to refer to a big tragedy in some organization or business or governmental administration or whatever it might be, you know. Boy, that's a real train wreck. In other words, it's a big thing, it's moving fast, and now all of a sudden it's falling apart. And the reason that phrase is used is because it's so picturesque. I've witnessed some train wrecks in some families and some train wrecks in some churches. And it's usually because somewhere along the line something gets derailed, you see. All right. This particular section, section 3 of the Standing Resolutions, concerns personnel and employees of the church. Don't misunderstand this section by thinking that it only deals with people who are paid. Okay? I always draw a lot on military terms because they mean a lot to me, having been in the military. There are two resources that you have in any organization. Two resources, and these are military terms. Personnel, and the other one is called materiel. It's a French word. And most people, whenever I use that word, they always correct my pronunciation. I'm not talking about material, okay? I'm talking about materiel. In other words, it's the physical equivalent of the word personnel. Personnel refers to people, and materiel refers to equipment, okay? Things. Physical things, properties, okay? And those two have to be coordinated. If we spend all of our emphasis on our materiel and we don't have properly trained personnel, then we can have problems. On the other hand, if we spend all of our emphasis on personnel but we don't get them the proper equipment, then they can't do what they need to be doing. George Patton, I suppose, was one of the more brilliant of the combat generals. He didn't make a real good peacetime general, but He was an excellent combat general in that he understood the balance between those two things. And he could move people faster than any other general in his era. And the reason he was able to do it is because he understood their needs for materiel. Everybody wanted to serve under Patton. And all the Russian soldiers especially, or all the German soldiers especially, wanted to surrender to Patton. I mean, if they knew they were beat, they would march across the country to be able to surrender to Patton. Why? Because it wasn't a disgrace to get beat by him. I mean, most people did, okay? And so if they got beat by him, at least they were able to save face. Let me tell you some of the things he did. He saw to it that his men, regardless of where they were, had one hot meal a day. He saw to it that his soldiers got one pair of dry socks every day. Didn't matter if they had to throw the old ones away. Give them a pair of dry socks every day. Why? Can't fight with wet feet if you're sick and don't feel good and hungry and all that sort of thing. And you know the famous story about the time that they had horrible weather. And he ordered his chaplain to compose a prayer asking the Lord to clear up the weather so they could get back to war. And the chaplain protested. And he said, God is sovereign over the weather. He said, well, this is your department. Killing Germans is my department, and speaking to God about the weather is your department. Now, you get me a prayer. And so he came back and thanked the Lord for his strength in helping them as warriors to, you know, have clear weather for battle. The weather cleared. And in Patton's diary, it was Christmas morning, 1944. He said, Christmas morning dawned cool and crisp, a beautiful day for killing Germans. That's what he put in his diary. The man was single-minded in his focus. He was determined. But he understood the balance between materiel and personnel. A lot of times churches have a little struggle with those two things. You've seen some people where they overbuild the capacity of the people to follow the building program or to fund the building program. Then there are others, and I think we've been guilty of some of this, where we spend so much time concentrating on the needs of the people and maybe drag our feet a little bit on getting the buildings going and so on. There has to be that balance. So here in the Constitution, we have dealt with that. And when we talk about personnel, we're not just talking about employees, remember that. These principles apply to anybody who is part of the personnel department. Now remember, either you're personnel or you're materiel. Okay? Either you're a worker or you're a piece of furniture. Okay? Now, the key to remember that my dad used to use an illustration like this. If you want to be treated like a person, then you got to get up and move once in a while. Okay? If you want to be treated like a piece of furniture, then just sit there and collect dust. Okay? One of the big problems we have in our churches today is we have some people who have assumed the function of furniture who don't want to be treated that way. You understand what I'm saying? All right. Here's what it says. Resolve that since no man can serve two masters, Matthew 6:24, no man can serve two masters. That's why we always encourage people not to get into a 50-50 business partnership. If you are in a 50-50 business partnership, everybody down the line has two masters. That's a difficult situation to be in. Since no man can serve two masters, there must be a clear line of authority for each employee, worker in the church. The senior pastor will establish the organizational structure for the church employees. He will work in conjunction with the other pastors and the budget committee in the establishment of working schedules, vacations, rates of compensation, and benefits for the employees and other related matters. That's how we do that. We get together, we sit down, and we say, this is what we feel like we need to have in order to get the job done. And there are other counselors, people who are involved in these kinds of things, who say, well, now this has to stay in line with everything else. We don't think we can afford that. Or maybe we need to do it this way. And we work it out, and we come up with some solutions about how many people we're going to employ and then how many other people we're going to have to use as volunteers. We have a lot of volunteer help in this church. And that's tremendous. And there would be no way that we could do what needs to be done without that. One of the key areas in which we need to continue to grow is in the area of caring for other members. In visiting visitors and new members, in visiting prospects. You sit down and figure out the mathematics of the thing, and you'll find that there's no way on earth that we could ever employ enough people to care for the needs of the church. What we'd have to do is we would have to have half as many employees as we do members so that they could take care of the others. Statistically, that's what you'd have to do. Well, that's not realistic. So what you do is you employ those people who can then equip and train and manage some others. Each individual has enough time to take care of himself and his own family and about six or seven other people, spiritually speaking. When you get beyond about six or seven, the time becomes so unwieldy that you just can't manage it. Now, we've got more deacons than that. We've got three times more deacons than that. That means that there's no way that the pastor could even adequately meet the needs of the deacons. So what we do is we take individuals on the staff and we break up the tasks and we assign the responsibilities out and we meet with small groups. Each of us has about seven or eight key people that we work with who can then work with seven or eight other key people who can work with seven or eight other key people. And you don't have to get down to about three, maybe four levels till everybody's covered. You see? Principle they used to teach us in the military is stay informed two levels down, command one level down. Now, the big problem that you have in the military and other organizations is that people want to command three, four, five layers down into the organization. And it gets too big. You can't do it. You don't have enough time to stay on top of everything. And you're always running around fretfully, frantically, trying to figure out what's going on. And it never works. Okay? Concerning hiring and dismissing personnel, the senior pastor shall have the authority to employ needed personnel at his discretion within the approved budget of the church. He may hire and appoint pastoral assistants. He shall have the authority to dismiss or replace any employee of the church. He may delegate this responsibility to other managers as necessary. Simple. Now, stop me at any time and ask questions or make comments. Why do we have that in our church constitution, somebody says? Because it's a simple matter of establishing policy and procedure. You see, some people have the idea sometimes, well, now, wait a minute, the pastors, they're supposed to meet my spiritual needs, but I don't really, you know, they don't have authority over the employment matters. When you run into a problem like that, you've already got a two-master principle. A lot of denominations use the concept that the employees of the church have a business accountability to someone other than their spiritual authority. You see? And that's not really the case. A person should have the same business response in a church now, should have a business responsibility to the person that has their spiritual authority, because the two go hand in hand. But the spiritual authority would be well advised to focus on the spiritual leadership and not on the business authority. You see? Because if we come on too strong, one of the big problems that you run into in employment situations is whenever somebody isn't cutting the mustard employment-wise, and you have to say, I think maybe we need to make some other arrangements, it's very easy for that person to feel like they're being spiritually disciplined. Very difficult. It takes an unusual person who's really wanting to be accountable and grow to be able to stay in a church once they've been employed by that church and for some reason have left that employee. Very difficult, especially if the relationship was tough or difficult or there's some duress involved in the termination. But there are some unusual people who can do that and some people who can grow from it. The pastor has the authority to dismiss or replace or to delegate the authority to dismiss or replace those who are employed by the church. Then we have a section in here, and I know you don't have this in front of you unless you just happen to bring it with you in anticipation of today, concerning loyalty, complaints, and appeals. The pastors that have asked to see our church constitution marvel at this section and say, boy, I would have never thought to put that in there. Well, I got to tell you, I borrowed this from somebody else. I borrowed it from a well-known college. Take your pick. Concerning loyalty, complaints, and appeals. The leadership of Faith Baptist Church stands for internal harmony. And while friendly to constructive criticism from employed staff, will not tolerate destructive criticism. I wish I had a few months to tell you about the pastors who tolerated destructive criticism in their church until there was nothing they could do about it. You see, the toleration of destructive criticism is like standing in the pulpit and saying, this is true, and then coming out among the people and having them say, no, it's not. What kind of a relationship can you have like that? You know, I mean, really, let's apply it to a family. Now, I don't mean to be impudent in my application here, okay? But suppose, for example, in your family, that you had constant back talk and sass of a parent. What kind of influence would that parent be able to have over that child? Hardly any. Hardly any. You see? If the parent really wants to influence that child, he can't tolerate backtalk and sass. He's got to deal with it. He's got to deal with it early. Okay? Now, I don't mean to indicate that we're talking about backtalk and sass and things like that in the church. Please, I'm not trying to use those words. That's almost insulting. I understand that. But there's a principle involved that if people in the pew, or the chair, as it were, are allowed to deny what's being taught from the pulpit, the ministry is being undermined. You know what it means to undermine something? I mean, if you have an embankment and you dig out under it, you mine out under it until it collapses. That's what we're talking about. It digs out the foundation. Yes, sir?
There would be a difference between the recommendation and constructive criticism.
Well, constructive criticism and a recommendation may be similar, and any constructive criticism is acceptable. Right. Now, let's distinguish not between recommendation and constructive criticism. Let's distinguish between constructive criticism and destructive criticism, because those are the two things that we're talking about. Constructive criticism is always welcomed. Sometimes people offer constructive criticism in a destructive way. They need to be taught how to help and how to serve and how to appeal. Okay? There are sometimes people who see a legitimate problem and who are trying to help with that legitimate problem, and their motives are really right. They just don't know how to do it. Generally speaking, what we have experienced here, when people come with an inability to articulate their constructive criticisms, it's because they're afraid. They have been in a situation where whenever they brought something up, that was other than just saluting the flag. Somebody jumped down their throat, okay? And they're afraid it's going to happen to them here. Might have happened to them here, okay? We're not perfect, all right? But somewhere they learned that, you know, if I say anything about this, somebody going to jump down my throat. But it's got to be done. So they'll come, and they'll be a little bit belligerent, defensive. And when people are fearful or defensive that they're not going to get a hearing or that their views are not going to be respected, they usually come on a little too strong, okay? Now, a wise leader will recognize that there are two problems indicated there. One, the thing the person's pointing out, and the second, the person's inability to clearly point it out in a non-threatened way. Because a person who's threatened would usually be threatening. You see, if somebody feels like they're backed in a corner, they're going to be a little more aggressive. All right? Because they don't have any alternative as far as they can see. So the wise leader in a situation like that will do two things. He will put the person at ease by listening to the criticism carefully and not correcting and not rebuking the method of correction that's being used. You see? And take to heart the criticism. And then at another time when it's more appropriate, teach and instruct and help the person understand how to offer the criticism in a non-threatening or non-destructive way. So it's our responsibility not only to listen to constructive criticism, but also help people learn how to criticize constructively. You see? Now, on the other hand, destructive criticism can be offered, listen now, very, very graciously. And that's usually the most damaging kind. And all you can do there, really, how do we know that criticism is destructive? It depends on the intention. It depends on the motive. Somebody says, you're judging my motives. Maybe so. There are times when leadership has to judge motives. Has to. And has to be good at it. It has to be gifted to make sure that motivation is evaluated properly. And anybody who has ultimate authority for a decision, excuse me, final authority for a decision, is going to have to judge somebody's motives at some point in time. And they have to be as fair-minded and as gracious and as kind as they possibly can about it when they're doing it. You see? Because all of those are factors. Now, we need to be careful that we don't jump to conclusions about people's motivations. Okay? But if we know somebody through having watched them and observed them and counseled them and taught them and seen their responses and their reactions, and we know in our hearts that the reason that they're offering a particular suggestion, however sweetly, is to advance or promote self over Christ, we have to restrain that and hold that back. Why? Because when pride is introduced, the Lord resists. You see? And when pride is introduced into an organization, the Lord resists. Into a ministry, the Lord will resist. So it's extremely important that whenever, and everybody in here is in leadership. You see? One car in the train is in leadership with the car that's behind it. And therefore, all the cars that are behind it. Isn't that right? And so everybody needs to understand these principles of leadership. We cannot tolerate destructive criticism. Why? It undermines the ministry. Because it undermines the structure of authority. Destructive criticism derails the train. It's not because the leadership is insecure. Now, there are times when some people will say, I've heard one preacher who says regularly, I've heard him say it on tape and in other places many, many times, don't you ever, ever criticize anything I say in the pulpit. Never correct me for anything I say in the pulpit. That's arrogance. That's arrogance. It's dumbness. You know? I mean, what if he's wrong? What if he makes an obvious mistake? What if he, like me, gets up and preaches one whole message on Moses and calls him Noah? Okay? I'd like to know I did that. I want to get that tape and don't let that get out. Okay? I mean, what if you make a mistake? What if you get up and you misspeak yourself? Okay, as the politicians say, that statement is no longer operative. You know, I thought that was going to get me off the hook, but it didn't, is what that means. Okay? Every employee will be informed that at any time he or she has any cause for complaint, he or she may come to the senior pastor or one of the other pastors involved and make his complaint. Pardon me if I don't keep using both pronouns, all right? Make his complaint. But no complaint is to be made to anyone with whom he associates in the church or anyone away from the church as long as the person is employed by the church or its related ministries. What does that mean? If you want to help the ministry and you see a problem, you deal with that problem with the person who can do something about it. Don't go to somebody who is not related to the problem, who is neither a part of the problem or a part of the solution, and involve them in it. What is that called? It's called gossip. And it is as worthy of discipline as any other sin. Now, one of the things that I notice, and I don't mean to be unkind by this, and certainly I'm not saying this for the sake of the visitors, but from time to time, somebody will come, and let me just use some of my own relatives, okay, who visited the church here, and they'll say, boy, I tell you, I don't see how you all do it. I just don't see how you've gotten a group of people who have that spirit of oneness and that sense of, I mean, it's just marvelous if more churches could have that. And sometimes I feel like saying, you know, one of the unique things about our church is we wouldn't put up with somebody like you. Now, I don't mean to be unkind by saying that, okay? But all during the course of that conversation, the many conversations that I've had with people, there has been criticism and undermining and disloyalty of their ministry while praising ours. Okay? I hope and pray that if you ever do that anywhere else, I find out about it. Okay? I don't think you do. There have been a few times, and I have found out about it. See, what am I saying? I'm saying that disloyalty right there, when tolerated, is what makes the kind of fellowship that we have here impossible. That kind of disloyalty to the Lord and disloyalty to your friends. Listen, if I let you criticize somebody behind their back to me, I'm teaching you to do that. And I'm a fool if I don't realize you'll do it to me too. You see? You have somebody come to you and criticize you, or you have somebody come to you and criticize somebody else behind your back. If you listen to that, you're just adding your name to the list of people they're going to criticize. I had a fellow give me a little rumor one day. I didn't ask for it. I wish I hadn't heard it. But he says, did you hear about so-and-so? I said, brother, I wish I hadn't heard that. And he said, yeah, that's what I heard. I heard brother so-and-so left his wife. I said, well, you know, I'm part of the problem now. And so as soon as he left my office, I called the man on the phone. I said, this man, I named him, was just in my office, and he told me you left your wife. And he laughed. He says, I don't know where that's coming from. He says, I've heard that 3 or 4 times. I said, well, if you want to nip part of it in the bud, you better give this brother a call. About 15 minutes later, the fellow who'd left my office called me back, and he said, brother, I need to ask your forgiveness. Now, he could have been uppity and wrong about it. He could have got angry, and he could have gone around and criticized me. Don't ever tell him anything. He can't keep a confidence. He should have told me that, and he knew he should have told me that. No, that wasn't true. Even if it was true, he should have told me. You see? But we were able to deal with that thing. Now, I wish I was 100% consistent in that thing, but I try my best to be as consistent as possible. You see? So what's the point? The point is, we need to either be a part of the problem or a part of the solution. And if we're not a part of the problem, we get involved, then we have to become a part of the solution. That's the way you maintain relationships. That's the way you build things and keep it going. Okay? No complaint is to be made to anyone with whom you associate in the church or anyone away from the church as long as the person's employed by the church or its related ministries. No employee will criticize the administrative policies of the church except to the pastor or the proper executive to whom he is responsible. Okay? Yes, sir. Come to me. Okay? I'll tell you. We have an organizational chart. Everything that's going on in the ministry is on the organizational chart. Military. Okay? One of these little things, a little needle going down here, 2 little boxes, you know, a little needle. You know, that's the way it works, okay? You know what that means? That means this guy gets the needle, these guys, and gets, you know, that's the way it works. Sometimes the needle's turned the wrong way, you know? Sometimes you have little dotted lines, and, you know, and sometimes it's kind of complex to organize all that. But organizational charts, everything that's going on here is on the organizational chart. We know where all the blank ones are, too, where we can plug people right in. Okay, now let me give this to you real quick, and then we're going to go. If after presenting a complaint and after the matter has been discussed and the pastor or other executive has made a decision, if a decision is not satisfactory, the employee must be loyal to the pastor and to the policies of the church if he's to remain as an employee. What that means is if you're teaching a Sunday school class or working in Awanas or anything else and you have a problem, you go right up the chain of command, and when it's resolved, whether it's satisfactory or not, you have to submit to it if you're going to continue to serve. You know why that's important? Because if you don't submit to the chain of command, at some point where you disagree with authority, you've established a two-master principle. And that's impossible. Yes, sir?
What's chain of command?
Chain of command. Okay. The word chain of command is another military phrase which refers to, I know Scott knows that, but he wants you to know it. It refers to the fact that this person is in charge, you know, and it goes down the line. You know, in the military, you got the general, and you got the colonel, and you got the lieutenant colonel, and the major, and the captain, and the lieutenant, and all of us, okay, but enlisted people. But chain of command means you give the order down the line like that, and this person hands it to this person. And it's a series of people who are in line. Yes, sir?
What is our chain of command?
It depends on what ministry you're talking about. Ask me a ministry, and I'll tell you. Choir, okay? What, beg your pardon? Well, Pastor Dixon, okay? In other words, Pastor Dixon reports to me. The Awana commander reports to Pastor Dixon. The leaders of the various groups report to the Awana leader. The helpers and teachers report to their particular group leader. That's the way it works, okay? If you were working in Awana, you would.
Okay?
Sure they have, okay? Let's use the choir, for example, okay? Van Kersup reports directly to me, okay? Everything else in the music ministry ultimately, therefore, is under his chain of command. Okay? So if somebody comes to me and they haven't yet, and Pastor or Dan Kersup doesn't know about it yet, then I know that the chain's been broken somewhere. Okay? And my responsibility then is not to respond to the criticism, but to go back to where the chain was broken and plug it back in. So if you come to me and you have a problem and you haven't followed proper procedure, the first piece of advice I'm going to give you is to go back to where the chain got broken. Now, does that mean I don't want to hear about it? No, it means it's far more important to maintain the chain than it is for me to give you an answer. You see? Yes, sir? Well, in a sense it does. Now, there's a freedom. We don't want you to feel like this is rigid and that you can't come to us, okay? But on the other hand, we have two things to do when you come. One is see to it that you get the help that you know you need. And the second thing is make sure that the fabric doesn't unravel, okay? See, because if I can only deal effectively with 7 or 8 people, and when anybody who's not one of those 7 or 8 comes to me, I add another one. And the next time somebody comes to me, I add another one. And the next time somebody comes to me, I add another one. And the next thing you know, I have 300, 400 people on my list, and I'm not meeting anybody's needs. You see? So we have to, you know, maintain those things, but make sure everything stays where it's supposed to be. Well, you get this and read it. Okay? Yes, sir. All right, make her quick. That's it. Well, no, ask it. You got everybody wondering now.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Sure it is. Sure it is. Keep your appeal as low or as far down in the chain as you possibly can. Always solve your problems at the lowest possible level. Okay? So because it affects the fewest number of people. You see, the lower down in the chain you go, the fewer people are affected by it. That's just a management principle. Sure he did. Yeah, that's exactly right. And look what had happened to him if he hadn't. Okay, now remember this. There's one more thing I want you to understand. Down here in number 4, and you get this. The wife or husband of an employee of Faith Baptist Church or its related ministries is to be as loyal to all the positions set forth in the Creed, Covenant, and Standing Resolutions as the employee is. And if it is found that the husband or wife of the employee has a critical attitude toward the church or its related ministries and is not cooperating in maintaining the position set forth therein, the employee shall be discharged. I tell you what, that particular problem right there is one of the key things that most churches wish they had the right to do. And you know what? They do. They just never thought of it. What we're saying is we're not going to pay somebody to undermine this ministry. And we're not going to pay somebody for their spouse to undermine this ministry either. Okay? Now you say, boy, that sounds awful strict and rigid. I ain't going to have any problems if nobody does it. You see? We're really not. What I'm saying is, we got the death penalty in here. Okay? Okay? We got the death penalty for your employment. We got the death penalty for your ministry in here. There are some things that you can do that will get you the death penalty in this ministry, okay? In other words, you won't serve here if you do those things. And the main thing is disloyalty. There is a way to deal with problems, and disloyalty isn't it. And if your spouse isn't loyal, then you can't be effective. Now, that's pretty... I hate to stop on that note, but we got to stop, okay? So, don't forget it, and sometime here in the future, we'll come back and we'll talk about it some more, okay? All right, let's pray. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for these people. Give us a good day. Lord, thank you for our mothers. Thank you for their influence in our lives. Help us, Father, to rejoice together and give honor to thee for your influence in our lives through them. Bless now our time of fellowship as we anticipate the beginning of the morning service. In Jesus' name, amen.